Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. Our only case for today is 00-3403-CR, State v. Nancy Lamon. And arguing on behalf of Ms. Lamon is Attorney Timothy A. as a provost. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. As the Chief has said, my name is Kim Provis. I like to pronounce it Provis. And I wrote appellant's briefs.
I'm having difficulty hearing this morning, and I'm just going to...
Is that better, Your Honor?
I'm going to sit up straighter. Maybe that will make a difference. I don't
know. Maybe it should be...
Just shut it off if you want. I don't care.
Thank you.
Is that okay?
Well,
about 160 years ago, a young French nobleman who was a magistrate named Alexis de Tocqueville came to our shores on a commission to study American prisons. And he did a lot more wide-ranging investigation and produced the well-known treatise Democracy in America, which is now well-renowned for its prescience. Perhaps the most prescient statement he made was the most formidable of all the ills that threaten the future of the Union arises from the presence of black population upon its territory. And he said the reason for that was because as slavery recedes, the prejudice to which it has given birth is immovable. And in this case, I guess we find that all those 160 years later, his prediction is still true. Prejudice is immovable and intractable. We can't do anything about the prejudice, but we can do something about discrimination. And our law since the Civil War, the Reconstruction Amendments, the civil rights statutes of the 60s, and all this that's in jurisprudence is aimed at a colorblind constitution and a firm commitment of American law to eliminate discrimination. So that's the underlying principle in our case, and the state, of course, doesn't disagree with that principle. In terms of what this case is about, how are we going to judge discrimination? As you know, I generally like to focus the court's attention on the broad principles that are involved in the case, but judging is a business that in specific cases it doesn't lend itself to specific rules. I fully agree with the totality of circumstances test, and I think the only thing that I can offer from the past as far as using it is Justice Stewart's famous statement in his concurrence in Jacobellis versus Ohio about a different kind of law, that I know it when I see it. However, it's clear to me, and I'll just pass on this anecdote, that trial judges do need as much guidance as the court can give them. 30 years ago, I was discharged from the service, and I came back to campus to finish my bachelor's degree, and I had two roommates who were in law school. Both of them sit on the circuit court now, and I still keep up with one of them. And at a Badger tailgate that we were at this fall, I discussed this case with him, and he says, "Well, gee, I didn't know I could do that." He says, "I thought I had to accept whatever explanation the prosecutor came up with." I says, no, this is the most important part of the case." So if my friend's opinion is or thinking is any indication of the matter, it's important for the court to perhaps restate the power of the circuit court and perhaps make some amplification of the factors in Walker. Now, I called them factors. I reviewed them this morning. I find that they aren't really factors. They're the list at 154 Wis Second, 173 to 172, or 174. Basically, they're not factors. They're distillations that the Walker Court made from decisions.
Counsel.
I'm sorry. They're not factors, really, that the court said had to be used, were set in stone or anything. They were simply distillations of previous decisions in other jurisdictions.
Counsel, I'd like to cut to the chase a bit.
Sure, Your Honor. The only other...
May I do that? May I ask you a question?
Go right ahead, Your Honor. I'm ready.
Okay. Did you have something more that you wanted to add?
Well, the only other thing was I wanted to say is from my personal experience as a appellate advocate, I often get these common law issues where there's a list of factors. And I sometimes, frankly, don't know which way they cut. I mean, I suppose I should, but if it's a new issue that I'm just... So I'm wondering if, you know, that's something in going over a list of factors, a non-exclusive list of factors that the court might want to add to or subtract from or whatever, it would indicate clearly which way the factors cut. I mean, I could be wrong, but if I'm sometimes confused about that, maybe trial judges are too.
Justice Babbage.
Counsel, in your brief, you speak to the failure to voir dire this individual juror. I'd like you to tell me what questions you believe should have been asked by either the prosecutor or the trial judge in an individual voir dire of Mr. Bell, I guess.
Well, the prosecutor rattled off sort of a laundry list of reasons for the strike, and I would have liked to see her ask some questions about them. Primarily, in addition to that laundry list, I would have liked to...
Would it have been proper for the prosecutor to have asked those kinds of questions solely of Ms. Bell, of Mr. Bell?
I don't see why not.
In the presence of the other jurors?
She had already asked, well, let's put it this way. The way this voir dire went down, if you followed my reply brief, I tried to outline it. She asked some specific questions about crime.
Of the whole panel.
Right. Some of the jurors volunteered. She asked the question whether they knew anyone who was a victim of crime. Some of the jurors volunteered the information that they were related to people who had been convicted of crime. And then prosecutor followed up on those questions in an effort, I assume, to find out if they could be fair despite that. Now, I don't see why it would be singling out Mr. Bell to simply ask him the same sorts of questions. Well, ask him whether he had a relative that he was... because this is what she was contending in with her list of contacts. She was contending that the person was related to people who were involved in crime with her list of contacts. Well, why didn't she just ask him about those contacts?
May I? Go ahead, Justice Babbage. I want you to finish.
Well, the prosecutor stated that she was concerned that Bell was not responding to questions and it was not being completely forthright and honest.
Mm.
How would that have been cured by asking any questions? Because she'd already asked those questions and Bell had not raised his hand, apparently.
Well, if she... Gee, Your Honor, I guess you're making the assumption that what the prosecutor is saying is correct, and I don't agree with that assumption. I guess what...
I'm not making that assumption at all, Mr. Provis.
Okay. The juror would have had the opportunity to answer those questions and state and tell the prosecutor either, yes, I lived there during this period of time, and yes, my uncle, my father, whoever had a complaint by my mother over this thing, or no, I wasn't there. I guess, Your Honor, forgive me, but I guess I don't understand your question. Could you repeat it?
I asked what specific questions should have been asked by the prosecutor of Mr. Bell. Mm-hmm. That's the question.
Well, she should have asked him about her list of contacts. This is what she had produced to the court as evidence that he would be biased as evidence for her strike.
I have a question that goes beyond that. If I read your brief correctly, you seem to think that it's Mr. Bell's credibility that's at issue here.
Not exclusively, Your Honor.
And but I would say that what we have, well, you say you don't have, you have a de novo standard of review because the trial judge didn't hear Mr. Bell. Therefore, nothing that the trial judge, there was nothing in this record that somebody who was present, namely the trial judge, would know better than the appellate court would know because it's just a plain reading of the record. The questions were asked. Mr. Bell did not raise his hand or comment, right?
Right.
Mr. Bell is absolutely silent. So as to the credibility of Mr. Bell, we can tell it from the record, not from how he looked or anything else, okay? I think the issue here is the intent of the state.
Mm-hmm.
That's the third issue. Did the state intend to discriminate?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Isn't that the ultimate issue here? So mm-hmm. it's the credibility of what the prosecutor is saying. So I don't know whether the focus should be on what Mr. Bell was or wasn't asked, but that's obviously some of an issue. But I want to know, in the record, how many of these, and we've got 101, page 101 in the record to page 116 of the record of the prior incidents at 1216. Mm-hmm. I want to know how many apartment units are there in this? There are three addresses, 1216, 1098, 1098, Keeler and White. How many apartment units?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay. Did the prosecutor check on anyone else? She obviously did a criminal search or some kind of search on these. Did she check every other address?
Well, that's what I'd like to know, too, Your Honor. When I did the post-conviction motion, I considered, because I had been conferring with Professor Ross, who had a companion case with the same juror, I had been conferring with her, and we had discussed doing a discovery motion from the prosecutor as to what she had
is
done.
Is that done?
When I read the your governing case on that kind of discovery, I didn't see where I could meet the burden. So I didn't
well,
make a motion.
We have this report here,
mm-hmm.
and it's a little hard to read, and I get a little bleary-eyed, but I read that there were maybe two or three times, and I confess I can just be wrong because I get a different number every time I read it, only two or three times where they mention the name of the problem person.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true.
And one is Jeffrey and one is Gene. And if there's another one, which I once found, I can't find it. And there are several other names. Amy keeps coming up. And so how do we know from this? And a Terry Golden is in it. How do we know that all of these are Bells? They're just two Bells. How many Bells are there in the Beloit telephone directory?
I don't know the answer. I don't think I know.
Can we take judicial notice of that?
I think so, Your Honor. I think you could. She may have. Your Honor, let me take a moment and look this over. Yes. Professor Ross made an offer of proof, which
this is in the other case?
In Gregory.
Right, okay.
Which the Court of Appeals did consider, but the actual text of the offer is not in the decision. But
I looked at the Internet, and I think there are 100, over 100. I don't know if that's correct. I did a fast look today. I could be wrong.
The offer of proof Professor Ross made in Gregory says a page from a Meritech phone book for Beloit, I don't know, he may have looked for other, shows 53 listings for Bell and Beloit.
Okay. That's in the telephone. Okay.
Can I clarify something for just a
minute? Of course.
Exhibit 1, which is part of the appendix to the state's brief,
yes, sir,
is this listing that the Chief Justice has been asking you about.
Yes, sir.
And I'm interested in knowing, was this presented to Judge Dahlberg, or was this presented for the first time at the post-conviction hearing?
No, the prosecutor had that with her, and it was marked as an exhibit. That's why we even have it. And, however, how much time the judge spent perusing it, I couldn't say.
Now, that was Judge Dahlberg then?
Yes, Your Honor, Judge Dahlberg.
Thank you.
Counsel, in response to a question earlier, you used the term burden, and I note that the state in its brief indicates that the defendant did not meet its burden. My question to you is, what is the burden? What do you have to what level must you show discriminatory intent?
You mean as clear and convincing?
Yeah. Do you have to raise a reasonable inference? Do you have to show beyond a reasonable doubt? What do you have to show?
Well, Your Honor, you caught me flat-footed. I don't know the answer to that question. It's not something I focused on. My understanding is that it's a burden, and it's by a preponderance, but I don't know. It's just off the top of my head.
Now, where is this other case involving the same juror? I mean, where is it in the system?
Oh, it's been decided. That's do you have the cite for that, Mary?
Is it a court of appeals decision?
Yes, Your Honor. Divided decision, State versus Gregory.
I'll find it, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. And the citation for it is in my reply brief.
What right are we dealing with here? What right of the defendant is being abridged?
The Batson case is based on the Equal Protection Clause, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
The Equal Protection Clause, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Well, let's just assume for the purpose of argument that there was racial discrimination here. He still had a fair jury. You're not arguing that any of the jurors were not impartial.
Well, no. I have no...
You have no showing of that.
I can't say that... I can't say that the rest of the voir dire wasn't proper and didn't...
That's right. You're not objecting that he didn't get... She didn't get a fair, impartial jury. Except for the Batson issue. But the jury that sat was okay.
In other words, following on Justice Bradley's question, no, I'm not arguing that it was a...
Why wasn't this harmless error?
Your Honor?
Why wasn't it harmless error?
Why wasn't it harmless? Well...
Assuming error.
There was
more than enough evidence to convict her.
As I understand the law, which could change, the equal protection violation means, as a matter of law, it's what the U.S. Supreme Court is now calling structural error, means that the fair trial guarantee was denied.
Regardless of the evidence.
Exactly.
Is there any other reason than the failure to ask individualized questions to prospective juror Bell, to support your position? I mean, is it all about asking questions, or is there something?
Well, no, Your Honor. Obviously, the third argument points specifically to the judge asked the prosecutor for the reason she didn't ask these questions. And she specifically stated that Well, she had previously stated she didn't think he was being forthright and honest because he didn't raise his hand to certain questions. And then when asked about why she didn't ask further questions on voir dire of the individual juror, she said that, "I didn't think his response would be forthright." So, you know, Your Honor, she prejudged his credibility. I mean, that's what that statement means. She's prejudging his credibility, and I don't know how you can get it.
What's wrong with is that if she makes a judgment of the person's credibility, mm-hmm. what does that violate?
Well, it's not fair. I mean, at some point, Your Honor, when I read that transcript, I'm reading through it, I'm thinking, oh, well, so there's a bad some thing. But then she says, "I didn't ask him any questions, and I'm making my own interpretation of these words because I thought he wouldn't tell the truth." I said, well, that's not fair. That's just not fair to the juror. And if the Equal Protection Clause doesn't guarantee that the juror has an opportunity is to be treated fairly, then I don't know what it's for.
Is it the failure to ask any individual voir dire questions that you're contending constitutes the evidence of purposeful discrimination
no.
under
well,
Title III?
That's one of them. The other thing is she stated her reasons. I mean, in these Batson cases, you don't often get where the prosecutor specifically states the reasons for doing something. I mean, they'll state, like she did here, well, his employment varies. But the court pressed her on her reasons, and she said, well, I didn't ask him any questions because I didn't think he'd tell the truth, or I didn't think he'd answer them forthrightly, which to me raises an inference that, A, she's afraid that he'll testify against her position, and B, that maybe her position isn't correct. She knows it. The U.S. Supreme Court has focused the one thing they have done as far as the third step goes is they focused the inquiry on the, quote, genuineness of the reasons for the strike. And if she says to the court that I'm not voir dire on this because the juror won't answer the questions truthfully.
There's nothing the matter with the prosecutor doing a background check on all the jurors,
no.
Is there?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's nothing the matter with the prosecutor saying there have been a lot of calls at the defendant at the juror's address, right? There's nothing
no,
the matter
you're
with that. Problem is how many bells there were in all of these reports.
Well, that's one of the problems.
That's a problem.
The other problem to me is
we don't know how many units there are.
Was that really the reason? I mean, we're focusing on the genuineness of this strike.
Well, I'm trying to get to how genuine it is.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry for interrupting.
One, did they do a background check on all the jurors, or did she select this juror? Do we know that?
No, Your Honor, we don't
okay.
know that.
We don't know how many apartment units there are.
Your Honor, you're way ahead of me on that. I never thought to consider that there was more than one. I assumed it was a single-family
How can you do that with three addresses and all these names, other names?
You can't.
Okay. So we don't know that on the basis of the evidence she is giving. We know that there are a lot of bells in Beloit. Do we know whether they're all related?
No, Your Honor, we don't.
The assumption might be that some of them are not related.
I can tell you what my client told me, if you want.
No, I want to know only what's in the record and what kind of record you made. So that goes to the genuineness of her explanation.
Yes,
and
sir.
And isn't that what is at issue before Judge Dahlberg?
Yes, sir.
And we review his determination of her credibility and genuineness and her intent on the clearly erroneous standard, because he did get a chance to see this DA and watch her in action.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't agree.
I don't agree with it
clearly erroneous here because as you say, as we say the focus is on the genuineness of the strike. Prosecutor's response to the final question shows that she was trying to keep evidence out that could challenge the genuineness of her strike.
What was that? What was that?
Oh, what evidence was that?
Yeah,
now you've got to. I've read from this offer of proof before.
Is it in this case?
No, this is in Gregory.
No, but you said to keep the. I'm just asking you.
Well, it was his answers to the questions as to whether he was related to this L person that she said was the big crime guy, whether he lived there at the time of the incident with the other Bell, I'm assuming she already knew that he didn't have any record because that's what prosecutors usually do. They run the rap sheets. But whether he, you know, was involved in crime at all or those sorts of questions.
Could I ask?
And that goes to what Justice Babbage was attempting to have you respond to on the questions and how it should have been handled. And that's what I'm...
Well, the singling... I expect she got the singling out justification out of the Davidson case. Sure, it would have been singling him out if she had taken an antagonistic attitude towards this church. Said, well, isn't it true that, you know, your dad and your brother and your related, blah, blah, blah. All she had to do was ask a simple question the way she'd asked the other jurors who had volunteered information about being related to people convicted of crime. Well, Mr. Bell, you didn't answer this question. You didn't raise your hand. On this question, I just want to make sure that, so I don't see how he's being singled out when she's already asked the white jurors those sorts of questions.
Well, you handle all the jurors the same, don't you?
Well, sure. She should have asked those Mr. Bell those same questions.
I think she asked, if I understand the voir dire, you ask general questions, mm-hmm. and then the jurors raise their hand and if they have an answer that they would like to give. That's normally the way it's done. They don't just spontaneously
respond. Oh, I understand that.
Yeah.
I understand that.
But I'm saying to handle it, everyone would be handled the same in the jury. You ask mm-hmm. these general questions and then you get responses. Mm-hmm. There's an assumption that do you know or are you related to, mm-hmm. that if you don't raise your hand, or say if I'm incorrect, tell me, then your answer to that would be, no, I don't know anybody. And isn't that that's the reason for that approach? The approach of asking all the jurors mm-hmm. the same question.
Yeah. I think what you're saying is silence is assent. Or silence means no or something. And
what do you think it means?
Well, I don't even know if Mr. Bell heard that question. Because there's nothing on the record about that. It sort of goes along with...
Then is the inference that a judge... because I used to do that, is that... The question would be, Mr. Bell, did you hear that question?
That would be a nice question to start off with, a non-antagonistic kind of question to say, well, you listening to me when I said this?
That's what I'm asking, how it would be handled.
Yeah, I think it's certainly possible to, as you say, to handle it without embarrassing the juror.
Wouldn't the judge then have to go around and ask the other people that didn't raise their hand, did they hear that question? Would that be a proper way to do it?
Well, I wouldn't object to that. I don't think it would be required.
Well, thank you, Mr. Provost. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Mary Burke, and we hope you're feeling better.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Mary Burke, representing the State of Wisconsin respondent in this matter. The State's interest in every trial is to see that the proceedings are carried out in a fair, impartial, and non-discriminatory manner. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court wrote in J.E.B. versus Alabama, and the State wholeheartedly endorses that concept. In the preliminary strike context, governed by the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, that fairness extends to more than just one participant, however. It extends to the litigants, whether they be civil or criminal, whatever their race, whatever their gender. It extends to the prospective jurors themselves, and it also extends to the broader community. The issue in this case has been framed as whether a prosecutor's failure to ask a veneer person individualized questions constitutes evidence of invidious racial discrimination. In some cases, absolutely yes. And Mr. Provis has identified some of those in his brief, and in the State's brief, we've distinguished those cases from the present case. In this case, the answer to that question is absolutely no. And the difference depends on the totality of circumstances that are present in each case.
Counsel, you use the term invidious discrimination, which to me is not the same as purposeful discrimination or discriminatory intent, phrases that are used. So I want to focus on that because that's something that's been bothering me in this case. I mean, conceivably, you can have invidious discrimination. You can have a jury that has been selected, which is the product of discrimination, invidious discrimination, without any ability to attack that because you have to show purposeful intent. So how can a juror, how can a defendant who's unable to establish purposeful intent on the part of the prosecutor still avail himself of the equal protection right when there is invidious discrimination?
Your Honor, in my mind, purposeful and invidious are really one and the same, and maybe invidious describes the purposefulness of the discrimination. Any discrimination in exercise of peremptory challenges exercised with the specific purpose of discriminating on the basis of race in and of itself is prohibited by the Equal Protection Clause. Now, there may be some circumstances where there is some resulting effect on the composition of the jury because the proponent of the strike exercised it on a basis that was not in and of itself racially purposeful or racially motivated, but had the effect of eliminating persons of some races or ethnicities from the juror. For example, a proponent might want to strike veneer persons for whom English was not their first language or who did not have an ability in the proponent's mind to follow proceedings in English or to adhere to the translations offered by an interpreter. Now, that might have an effect on the composition of the jury by removing some persons of various ethnicities or races, but because the purpose of the strike was not in and of itself racial, that type of strike is not prohibited by the 14th Amendment.
Ms. Burke, when that kind of thing happens, though, when, as here, the only African American is removed from the jury panel, should we be still applying the erroneous exercise of discretion, giving deference to the trial court's determination, or should we be looking at this with a higher degree of scrutiny, looking at it de novo, if you will?
Your Honor, the U.S. Supreme Court has been very clear that it's always the clearly erroneous standard that applies. And the reason for that is that the demonstration of a threshold showing of potential racial or gender or ethnicity bias occurs at the first stage of the Batson test. That's the prima facie showing that the opponent of the strike has to make. But it doesn't stop there. In the next step, the proponent of the strike has to offer a neutral explanation. But the burden never shifts from the opponent of the strike. And at the third stage, the opponent of the strike has an opportunity to offer evidence or questions or in other ways challenge the race or gender neutral explanation that's been proffered at the second stage. That burden always remains with the proponent.
Are you depending on the Hernandez decision of the U.S. Supreme Court for the position you're taking?
Among others, Your Honor, I think Batson itself also says that, that the burden always remains with the proponent. And if I could just add, the reason why so much deference is given to the trial court is because, as some of the cases have characterized this, the credibility of the proponent of the strike, the one who must offer the race-neutral explanation in the second stage, is really the heart of this analysis. And the trial judge there in the courtroom is an expert in making that kind of assessment, assessing the nonverbal, intangible, interpersonal relationships that occur in the courtroom, as well as the actual words of the veneer person or the proponent of the strike.
Well, is he assessing the juror here?
That's
credibility of the juror?
That's
or the credibility of the prosecutor, or both?
Both, although the credibility of the prosecutor is more important because it's the prosecutor's responsibility to offer the explanation why her strike was race neutral. And as that incorporates credibility of what a witness may, a veneer person may or may not have said, that's also relevant. But the primary credibility issue is that of the attorney proffering the strike.
My concerns, counsel, is premised on my belief that if an attorney cannot come up with a race-neutral explanation, the attorney shouldn't have gotten out of law school. The attorney, there's a couple of cases that the attorney needs to say more than it's my intuitive feeling, okay? That's a rule of law. The attorney can say this. Look, there are two blacks on the panel. One is Mr. Wilson and one is Mr. Williams. And you know, Judge, I'm the type of person that if my gas pump stops at the number 13, I put on more gas in just so I don't stop at 13. I'm the kind of person, Judge, that I don't like jurors who have a last name that starts after the letter V. So that's why I struck Williams and Wilson. What do you do with that?
Well, at the second stage, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that the excuse proffered doesn't even have to make sense.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. You see, if you have a right, if you have an equal protection right, then you have to have the ability to meaningfully exercise it. And I am suggesting that absent a worthless attorney who can't come up with a race-neutral explanation, there's no ability to exercise it in this kind of a situation where no questions are asked.
Your Honor, I think that's where the applicable test being the totality of the circumstances comes into play, because that explanation that's been proffered then has to be assessed in the context of everything else the judge knows and has observed.
If I may, counsel, let's say the facts are just like here. These questions were asked of Mr. Williams, of the general panel, in Mr. Williams and Mr. Wilson's case. So it's the facts just like here, except the race-neutral explanation was the one that I gave. How do you attack that?
Well, the architecture of the legal analysis that the U.S. Supreme Court has created really places the burden to make that important decision on the trial court judge. The judge has to assess whether or not a legitimate,
not legitimate
reason is being
not legitimate.
Race neutral. And if the trial court judge thinks that's ridiculous, does not have to uphold the strike. I think one of the Supreme Court cases, and it may be Perkett, says if a fantastic explanation is offered at the second stage, it can and probably should be found incredible at the third stage. But in the scenario that you've offered, we would want to know more than just that bare fact. We would want to know the prosecutor's conduct, what the veneer person had been behaving like in the courtroom during the course of the voir dire. The cases recognize that prosecutors and other attorneys historically have exercised peremptory strikes on the basis of what is sometimes characterized as hunches that are hard to articulate and have upheld the prosecutor's or the lawyer's attorney to do that so long as there isn't an apparent pretext involved.
And whose burden is it on step three? On step two, we don't evaluate the sufficiency of the reasons. We only look to see if they are facially not in violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And then on step three, as to pretext, who has to carry the burden?
That is the opponent of the strikes.
Right. And part of the problem in this case is that the way the argument went, it didn't proceed nicely and neatly along those three steps. It was sort of fluid, and the trial judge compressed his ruling into saying in one sentence, I find that the state has made its case for the strike. Let's move on.
Mm-hmm. Well,
we have to tease it out.
I think the judge's cursory ruling has to be construed as an adoption of the rationale that the prosecutor provided for her strike, and that was extensive. It did include the fact that she had this printout and the information that she knew from it. It did include the last name and her knowledge as a prosecutor about Christopher Bell, the big drug person in Beloit, as well as other Bells with criminal history. It did include her concern that Mr. Bell had indicated on his juror card that his employment varied. It did include her concern that he had not responded to questions. So all of those things, I believe, are incorporated by reference into the judge's decision. As a practical matter, these decisions are being made, as the former trial court judges know better than I, in the context of ongoing proceedings and busy cases. And while many of us in the legal world certainly wish we could be more articulate sometimes, we're not always as articulate as we might wish to be. And that leads me to a concern that I would have with what
Before
Mr. Pro-
you do your concern, I just pulled the State v. Gregory case, which refers to this case. This is a published decision, right?
Yes.
Does this case indicate that you can't have a post-conviction evidentiary hearing?
I believe the Gregory case does say that because the assessment of the prosecutor's or the proponent's strike needs to be made on the basis of what the proponent knew at the time the strike was executed. And my understanding from Gregory is that the desire was to bring forward additional information that was not, so far as the record reflects, known to the proponent of the strike at the time the strike was made.
And in Gregory, Mr. Bell did make various revelations about his family, as did others, about who used drugs.
Yes.
Not all of them were struck, were they?
I don't believe that we know that, Your Honor.
Well, we do know from that case that this was about the third time. This case here, this is the third time this same Mr. Bell was struck.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently in each of the other two times, he was the only black on the jury.
Mm-hmm.
Was this the first time he was struck?
I believe that's right, Your Honor.
The first time, and then he was struck again in Gregory.
Yes.
And that's the that case. So that's what Gregory is. Now, can I... Should the defendant have made a record that the prosecutor only checked on his his criminal record or his the arrest records in his building?
Yes. That was the defendant's burden to rebut the explanation offered by the prosecutor.
And maybe if they showed there were, and I can, 3, 5, 7, 9 apartments, units, that would have indicated, I guess the inference could be drawn that others than Bell were involved.
Yes, same thing for the number of people who were involved, the relationships of the people listed in the police printout.
Well, right on the face of this police reports, how many Bells did you count?
In addition to the ones that you mentioned before, Your Honor, I believe there's Sandra or Sandra Bell.
With, are there three?
I believe that's right.
That's, I once counted two, then I counted three the next time. Okay. Three out of how many of these? 19?
I did not count the total number of people listed.
There may be 19. Yeah. At least at the front sheet, it counts 19. So that would have been an argument, right?
Yes, although it might have backfired, too, because further explanation or exploration of who those people are might have revealed last names for people we don't know now.
Go ahead. And what do you think that high crime neighborhood is a code word for a minority neighborhood?
The case law recognizes that it can be, but it's not always. It wasn't in this case, I don't believe, given the way the prosecutor explained her concern about it. She noted crimes, she noted Mr. Bell's residence, and I would interpret her citation of high crime neighborhood in support of her view that there may have been crimes involved at Mr. Bell's residence.
Do we know whether or not there were, this was a majority or minority people residential area?
It's not in the record, Your Honor, but I think you could take judicial notice of census statistics or something if you wish to.
What did they show?
I don't know.
Okay.
Counsel, what is in the record, and I was reading this is in the blue brief in page 8
Sorry,
and 9.
I can't hear you.
This is in the blue brief at page 8 and 9. What I'm reading is the colloquy, the record between the defense counsel and the prosecution. I'm just gathering that one of the things when we have these on appeal, we're probably not quite as familiar, but I do note that, and I may have it wrong, but I wrote this down last night, that the defense counsel themselves, which I believe is Livingston, indicates also that 1216 Wisconsin is about 4 blocks from my house. In
yes.
other words, the defense counsel is acknowledging and says, although I believe that is a high crime area, that is the defense counsel mm-hmm. saying in answer to this is the colloquy between the judge, prosecution, and defense counsel. And I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the defense counsel.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an assumption when we get into this apartment, whether there are 8, 9, 4 different units, the assumption is that the defense counsel is familiar with that 4 blocks from my house.
Mm-hmm.
That, and my assumption is that 1216 seems to be a residence in which there has been at least, they have lived there for a number of years. That's the assumption that I get, and I'm just basing this on either the colloquy that right during the jury trial.
Mm-hmm.
And the So I'm trying to respond to some of the questions that have been asked here and that mm-hmm. I was looking at last night.
Your Honor, another thing I would note is that the relevant time frame for the incidents listed in the police report is probably about 2.5 years. I think the incidents start in January of 96. The offense committed here was sometime in 1998. The trial was in 1999. So the relevant window isn't really 1996 to 2003. It's a much shorter period of time during which those incidents occurred and which Bell was documented as being involved maybe 2.5 years before the incident.
Right. Now, my next question is, we talked in your opposing counsel, we talked about, well, prosecution didn't want a single, this is on page 11, I also did not want to appear as though I was singling him out under these circumstances. And this is after the prosecutor had gone through a number of reasons. What's wrong with asking? Wouldn't that have been the better way to ask questions?
Well, I think any individualized questions asked only to the only African-American member of the veneer would put a focus on that person that might be viewed as unflattering or perhaps an effort to develop a record that would support striking that specific person for cause. The problem with these laundry lists of factors that some of the other courts have developed is that a lot of them strike both ways, and this is a good example of that.
Let me give you just an example, because let's say there had been individual questions, and this is particularly about the close friend knowing anybody who had been the victim of a crime or convicted. Now, maybe this is more of a hypothetical, mm-hmm. but had the district attorney known that they had that information and then still struck, in other words, there would have been an assessment of credibility, and do you think we would have had the same, we could have had the same motion up here, because I don't know whether that would have been on the record, or then they would have had to come back in and say, well, I know of my own personal knowledge, or I was told by somebody in the police department that mm-hmm. they know each other. Mm-hmm. That's very difficult. And a lot of what I call jury picking is hunches, whether it's this jury or any other jury. People come in and they look at the person, they look at the body movements, they mm-hmm. all the other considerations. So I was just trying to figure out, if they asked this question singly, you're saying, well, that would have exposed them for a similar motion? I'm talking about the state.
On different grounds.
You're not suggesting that there's something legally impermissible or even legally suspect about individual voir dire of minority jurors.
No, but I think that it's important to keep the total context in mind. For example, Mr. Provis and I had discussed wanting to mention to the court that there is a Batson case now in the U.S. Supreme Court, Miller L. versus Cottrell, argued in October. And while the specific issue there is somewhat different from this case, it involves a pre-Batson trial and then subsequent introduction of statistical information. It is a possibility that the court will provide additional guidance regarding the third Batson step in that case when it issues its decision. But that case also is one in which there appeared to be differential questioning of minority jurors and white jurors, and that is now one of the issues that's before the U.S. Supreme Court.
It is or is not one of the issues?
It is.
Counsel? I want to return to the question of standard of review, and I want to incorporate in my question one of this Court's favorite subjects, juror bias. By preface, juror bias, as you well know, you've got the statutory jury bias, you have the subjective jury bias, that is, I can't be fair, Judge, but subjectively I'm saying that. And then the third type of juror bias is objective. This case, in my mind, parallels the analysis of objective juror bias. It does so because when assessing whether a juror is objectively biased, a circuit court must consider the facts and circumstances surrounding the voir dire and the facts involved in the case and make a determination. And your response here, you know, this is all very fact-dependent. You have to listen to what the prosecutor says with regard to race,
neutral. You have to observe the demeanor of the prosecutor and the juror members. So it's all very fact determinative. Yet, when you get to the standard of review of whether or not there is juror bias, as opposed to what we have in this case, bias towards the juror, the standard of review is a mixed question of fact or law. The circuit court's findings will be upheld unless they are clearly erroneous. However, whether those facts fulfill the legal standard is a question of law. Why isn't that same standard of review applicable in this case, which is whether there is bias towards the juror rather than juror bias, both going to the issue of the right to have a lawfully constituted jury?
Your Honor, the two determinations that have to be made are qualitatively different. In the 14th Amendment, the peremptory strike context, the U.S. Supreme Court has said the issue of discriminatory intent is a question of fact. And the Hernandez case addresses this. Once the trial court has determined that there was a discriminatory purpose for the strike, the analysis ends. That's the fact, and that's the ultimate constitutional conclusion. Whereas in the jury selection strike, the objective bias, it's a mixed question of fact and law, because the judge first has to ascertain the relevant facts, analogous to the fact of finding whether the strike was motivated by bias. But then, in the objective bias scenario, has to apply those facts to a legal standard. There's the specific legal standard of whether a reasonable person in the juror's position would be able to be impartial. And that second layer of analysis, a specific standard that has to be met, is what distinguishes the two.
Why aren't we, in essence, saying, would a reasonable judge in the judge's situation find this excuse to be pretextual?
Well, in a way, that's addressed by the clearly erroneous standard of review.
Well, but then that gets us to, as a matter of law, if we say a reasonable judge would have found this to be pretextual, that's a matter of law, de novo review.
Right. It's not a reasonable judge standard in peremptory strikes. It's bias, period. And if the judge is clearly erroneous in determining the existence or non-existence of bias, then the judge is reversed.
Ms. Burke, it seems to me from this record that the prosecutor knew that Mr. Bell might have problems, relationships, et cetera, and then she was prepared that she might have to strike him. And she knew that because she had this, she got this because she worried about him. I don't know that there's any other record. And she also told, I guess, maybe defense counsel, and I don't know about the judge, that if there was a problem with one of her strikes, they should go into chambers, right? So she was prepared for a Batson. Mm-hmm. You have that sense from the record?
I have the sense that she did her homework. I think the record also,
as the judge said.
And the record reflects that she waited to see what transpired during the voir dire.
That's right. She didn't strike him right off the bat. If he had answered all these questions, mm-hmm. She might not have struck him, although at least on the post-conviction, he did answer some of these. So you've got her prepared. Now they're both in chambers. The defense counsel knows that the state is going to strike Mr. Bell. Why couldn't the defense counsel ask Mr. Bell to come in and get it all on the record?
He could have.
Could have.
He could have asked for a recess. I think that's what Gregory indicates, that if defense counsel...
What would he do in the recess? He's not going to talk to Bell.
He could. He could ask Mr. Bell about his family situation, how long he'd lived
on the
record
address.
Mm-hmm.
Not in private.
Oh, yes, that's right. It would have to be on.
I don't understand. Okay, yeah. So he's not asking for a record. He's asking Mr. Bell either in open court mm-hmm. or in chambers.
Or could have investigated in other ways who lived at the address in question.
Would he have found out who lived at these three addresses?
Would he have found out?
Pardon me?
Would he have found out?
How could he have found
out? How could he have found out? Real estate records, telephone books, public record searches, these can be done on the Internet. Mm-hmm. Could have gone physically to the places.
The problem is they didn't put enough in. The defense counsel.
Ms. Bell's counsel failed to meet the burden that he had.
On which one? One, two, or three? One or three?
Three. Mm-hmm. Because one we never really dealt with in this stage. We went right to two when the judge asked the prosecutor for her explanation and she volunteered it.
I think that's ineffective assistance of counsel.
I don't know that it would be deficient performance or prejudice because we don't know what further investigation would have revealed. But this case isn't about that.
I have two questions. I hope they're short. As you know, when we write our opinions, we usually start off by stating the facts and then stating the issues. What do you think are the issue or is the issue or are the issues in this case? Not what the Mr. Provost says.
It seems to me that the main issue is whether the proponent of a peremptory strike must in every case ask follow-up questions, individual follow-up questions, if he or she is going to strike a juror on belief that the juror is not being straightforward.
Okay, then the second question, I just need this for my own information because mm-hmm. I want to explore it a little bit. What is the sequence of these cases in which Mr. Bell was involved? There were three cases. One of them is this one, the Lehman case, or Lamon. One is mm-hmm. Walker. Mm-hmm. And then there was a third.
Gregory.
Yeah. I mean Gregory. And then there was a third.
Your Honor, I believe that it was this case, the other case, and then Gregory, although I'm not confident of that. I'd be glad to check and send a brief letter to the court.
The other case go up to the Court of Appeals?
It's not published. I don't know if it was
And
litigated.
Was it the same prosecutor in any of these cases?
The prosecutor in this case was different from the prosecutor in Gregory. I know that. That was a man in that case.
So we don't know if they shared information or not. Because in Gregory, I noticed that there was individualized questions. And he did respond exactly the way the prosecutor in this case thought he should have responded to mm-hmm. the general questions.
Right. Was there information sharing in the DA's office? You know, quite probably.
Well, I think it says here that she did tell him. She told him that to watch out on Bell. And the Gregory is at the similar address or a similar area, if I understood that case.
It's the same address.
And
same juror, right?
And so we have that in the record that she did tell him. At least I remember that.
Chief, may I? Hopefully a quick question. I ask this of your opposing counsel. What is the burden that Ms. Lamon must satisfy? To what degree?
Your Honor, I'm not aware that it's been articulated any other way than enough to convince the judge. I'm not aware of case law that says preponderance.
Reasonable inference?
No. The judge is... and the opponent are entitled to rely on circumstantial evidence, on inferences from that evidence, on direct evidence. And the case law does say that the burden is not as high as would be required for a strike for cause. But short of that, I'm not aware of anything.
I'm sorry, but once we establish the burden, whatever it is, mm-hmm. and of course establishing the burden makes a difference. Mm-hmm. If it's a low burden, easier to meet, you know, pretty simple. But then don't we, as a matter of law, have to decide whether or not that burden has been met once we establish what the burden is?
No, I think you just have to determine whether the judge's decision is clearly erroneous.
Could I ask one question here? I served as a district attorney at one point, had no really background in law enforcement before I came there, but it wasn't too long that whenever a certain name came up, I would say, "Ooh, what's this?" In this case, you have a trial judge who was on the bench in Rock County for many, many, many years. And you have this exchange on page 6 of the appendix. The court says, "As I recall, you did not even ask him any individual questions. Do you have some reason for the strike?" "Yes, Your Honor. As the court is probably well aware, our office, as well as the federal prosecutor, has prosecuted a number of Bells who live in Beloit." What I'm trying to really get at here is, does the judge's knowledge and experience, is that a factor here at all that we should take into account, or he should take into account, or is that impermissible factor, or what?
Well, I think that it is permissible to take into account. It's part of the assessment the judge is able to make of the credibility of the proffered explanation, something the judge as a person brings into the courtroom. So I guess I would say yes.
Should the judge have said that then on the record? I'm familiar with the fact that there are a lot of Bells that have been before us.
He could have said that. It wasn't necessary that he said it.
We should just surmise that.
What was placed on the record was sufficient. We don't want these peremptory strike challenges to devolve into mini trials. The judge had to make a determination, did. There were adequate reasons expressed, and that should be the end of the inquiry. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burke. Mr. Provost.
It's Provost, Your Honor.
I apologize.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just have 2 points. I guess I couldn't let this argument pass by without saying that I do think it's the lamest kind of a rule in the world to say that it's okay to kick the guy off the juror, but it's not okay to question him individually, because it would be embarrassing to him to discriminate against him. I mean, they were in chambers in the first place. He could have been called into chambers. He wouldn't have been embarrassed in front of anyone.
What about the question?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
What about the question that was asked by the justices as to what the defense counsel could have done when they were before the judge asking, you know, for explanation whether he should or should not honor the strike? Could the defense counsel have done something then?
The defense counsel asked the judge to do the voir dire.
What I'm asking,
that the prosecution wouldn't do.
Couldn't be.
Should he have done an investigation?
Well, not an investigation, just questions.
Oh, question the juror himself.
Yes, sir.
In chambers. I wouldn't object to that. I mean, I don't think it's his burden to do it in the way this one went down. Certainly that could have provided the additional answers that we all wish we had in this case. I don't know whose burden it is. Then the other point I wanted to make was about a judge being able to rely only on demeanor. The reason I submitted this additional case, State versus Carter, after the briefing, was that it's a case of juror bias, which I assume is using the standards that Justice Brelli was talking about, where the Court of Appeals says that the clearly erroneous standard is particularly inappropriate where the juror wasn't questioned about his bias, and that the court's finding that his demeanor demonstrated impartiality isn't supported by the record because the record doesn't show that the judge observed his demeanor. So, for what that's worth. I guess I'm done. I want to say that this argument has been quite an education for me. I like to think I know what I'm doing, but a lot of you know it a lot better than I do. So I'd submit the case.
Thank you, Mr. Harvis. Thank you, Ms. Burke, for your argument in this Batson-type case that ends a hearing on 00-3403-CR. The court is in recess for a long time.